Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and happy Tuesday. Glad to have you with me, and if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com, and of course, naysayers go to the head of the line. So on this Tuesday, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. And our Twitter poll today, would a New York Times columnist make a great governor for Oregon? I happen to know this guy. I've known him for a long, long time. Have not spoken to him in a long time. He would make a terrible governor, but we'll get to Nicholas Kristof a little bit later on this hour. You can vote in today's Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com. Always glad to have you do that. Doesn't cost a dime. Now, I wanted to start with something. I'll get to the forest fires a bit later. I'll get to some of the other craziness that's going on in the Northwest a bit later. But I want to begin by talking about space. And I will admit, I've got a dog in the fight here. I love space. I have since I was a kid. I was a space enthusiast. Didn't exactly have the math scores or the science scores in school to be able to justify some kind of career in this. But I want to say something. I cannot stand the politics of Jeff Bezos nor Elon Musk. But congratulations to Jeff Bezos. If any of you saw that 11-minute flight where they went right to the edge of space, I thought it was a tremendous accomplishment. Now, an awful lot is being made of the fact that this is a billionaire guy and he's involved in a stunt. Do I like his politics? No. Do I fault him for being a billionaire? No, he made the money, honestly. I may hate his politics, but I sure love what Jeff Bezos just did with Blue Origin and the passengers who went along with him. And I think the steps that we've seen this year by private industry to begin to shove government to the side, it won't be out for a long, long time. In fact, government will probably always, because of space and because of defense and because of money, government will probably always have some kind of role in what goes on in space exploration. But seeing the private sector step to the fore, I think this is absolutely terrific. And you know what it reminded me of? I watched an interview, a documentary actually, about the creation of the Boeing Airplane Company. And it was a great documentary. I saw a Boeing historian quoted, and they talked about the fact that Bill Boeing had a lot of foresight. And when he started his aviation company, he literally wrote into the Articles of Incorporation. This was at a time when, they tell the story of how Bill Boeing actually went to California because they were having the first ever air show where they showed off the early airplanes that were flying then. You had no commercial air travel. You had no cargo travel by air. But he went down to this air show, and here's this guy who had made a ton of money in the timber business. But he wasn't that well known. And he tried for 3 days to volunteer to go up for a flight with one of these pilots in one of these very primitive and at the time very dangerous airplanes. And every single one of them turned him down. They took up other famous people like William Randolph Hearst and folks like that. But Bill Boeing got the cold shoulder. So he went back to Seattle. And according to the historian for the company that is now the largest aerospace company on planet Earth, I mean, so big it even swallowed up McDonnell Douglas, another major airplane company. When he first sat down to write up the Articles of Incorporation for the Boeing Airplane Company, he actually wrote into those Articles of Incorporation that someday the company would make major airplanes, would carry cargo around the country and around the world, that he would carry passengers. And nobody was doing anything of the kind at the time. And later on, it talked about the fact that he got an early contract to start carrying airmail for the first time, where you would move letters and packages across the country in these airplanes that were, again, still very, very primitive. And you know what he did? He said, I want to make sure we can take some passengers along with us. They actually made room in the mail plane at the expense of not being able to carry as much mail to carry two passengers on those early mail planes. They even put windows in the side of this. So you have basically a single occupant airplane, the pilot, who's sitting in an open cockpit. You've got the passengers in this little box down below, and they can only see out a tiny little window. And as they said, it was still very, very dangerous to fly. But he had the foresight to say, this is something we will be doing. We will carry massive amounts of cargo to every point in the country. Now, whether he could have imagined the day when Boeing 747s would carry cargo literally all over the world, but Bill Boeing had that foresight. I think in a lot of ways, Jeff Bezos is very much like Bill Boeing was in the early days of Boeing, that he says, look, we can see the private sector getting into this business. Now, this is different than aviation because even in aviation, you had a fair amount of government contracts early on, contracts to build airplanes for the military. And now we have Bezos and Musk and other people like Richard Branson who've decided we can get into this business. The private sector has a role to play in space. Well, imagine what this guy has done, an 11-minute flight. And I know a lot of people are going to argue, well, they only went to 62 miles. It's not that big a deal. Yeah, I think it is an enormous big deal to be able to have private industry build a craft. And, of course, he was the second to launch. Branson actually beat him to the punch right around 4th of July. But Bezos takes himself and several passengers into space. And at this point, he's not even the head of Amazon anymore. He's the he actually officially retired. But he scheduled the flight because today, the 20th of July, is 52 years to the day after Apollo 11 landed the first human beings on the moon. And Bezos went into space. He joined five other people on board Blue Origin's New Shepard spacecraft on its inaugural flight. Now, it's amazing to see what has happened. And the engineering behind these private sector efforts has already done some fairly dramatic things. They've brought down the fact, SpaceX has brought down the cost of getting 1 pound of cargo, any kind of cargo, into orbit. What it used to cost NASA, they now pay 1/20th as much to get a single pound of cargo into orbit. And Elon Musk is saying his new rocket is going to drop that number by another factor of 10. Now, the same amount of energy to get from New York to London, you can now fly from planet Earth to orbit. Could you have imagined the day where we would say it's possible to actually go down and buy a ticket? I guess they're talking about tickets on Blue Origin costing $250,000. And whether or not it'll be a moneymaker or not, if it's a loss leader, then God bless them. I'm glad to see them do it. I'm excited about the possibilities because I'm sure there have been plenty of people who've been skeptical. They were skeptical of airplane flight. They were skeptical that man would ever set foot on the moon. And of course, people are skeptical about billionaires like Branson and Musk and Bezos doing these kinds of things. But the fact that they're a little bit showy, the fact that they know something about marketing an idea is very, very important. This country was once almost on fire with the excitement to get into the space race, but that was the government-led space race. They got an awful lot of young men and women excited, and they became the scientists and engineers that got it done. In any case, congratulations to Jeff Bezos. Coming up, if you're choking on the smoke, just remember there's an alternative. My take coming up next.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Literally dozens of fires burn in the Pacific Northwest forests at this point. And the biggest of them, the Bootleg Fire in Oregon, is already more than two-thirds the size of the largest fire ever recorded in Oregon history. That was the Biscuit Fire back in 2002. Bootleg is the biggest single forest fire in America so far this year. But it doesn't have to be that way. And this is the point I've been trying to get across for so long. Forest scientist Dr. Bob Zybak points out that for 30 years between the mid-1950s and the mid-1980s, the Northwest had one large forest fire. What happened? Well, back then, we saw lots of logging in the forest. That created hundreds of thousands of jobs and kept the forest safe. They cut the trees, they made money, they paid lots of taxes, they built roads, and then they replanted the trees. And most of the trees planted back in the 1950s are at least mature enough to harvest again. But in the 1980s, anti-logging activists won court victories, and logging dropped to a fraction of its former glory. Now we've become accustomed to seeing hundreds of thousands of acres burn every single year. That is the new normal. Last year, the cost of fighting fires topped one-third of $1 billion in the state of Oregon alone. Oh, and 4,000 homes went up in flames as well. Every single year, billions of board feet of timber grows. We could cut that much every single year, and we would literally never run out of trees. Instead, we harvest a tiny fraction and leave the rest of them to simply burn. Now, if that makes sense to any of you, please call me up and tell me why. In the meantime, understand that the smoke you may be choking on right now is a choice, and it's an expensive one at that. And by the way, I'd be glad to take those naysayers. If you want to say it makes sense, we don't want to cut the trees down and turn them into something positive. And by the way, for the global warming crowd, if you want to encapsulate carbon, can you think of a better way than growing a tree, encapsulating all the carbon that's in a tree, cutting it into lumber, making it into a house? The house is going to sit there. If properly cared for, it could sit there for hundreds of years with all that carbon encapsulated. Or you could let the forest catch fire, in which case the carbon very quickly goes right back into the air. Again, somebody who can make sense of that, I'd be glad to listen to their argument. Eric writes in from Prineville, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars, longtime listener. First, I want to tell you I'm a vaccine resistor. Not because I'm too stupid to grasp science. Biden, Kamala, and Brown all said they wouldn't trust the vaccine. That and 4 years of resist is my reason for ignoring the jab. Strictly political. When I read that Biden and Brown are frustrated, well, that's the most fun I've had since the election. They said they wouldn't trust the vaccine. But we all knew that even if President Trump had been reelected, actually, I think he has been reelected, they would have taken it because they all believe that this is the Andromeda strain. Just wanted you to know it's all political and they did it. And from Twitter, Henry writes in, Lars, Governor Carbon Kate Brown will not allow the management of the forest lands in Oregon. The lack of management causes forest fires. Burning down the timber has become big business for Carbon Kate. She has the largest carbon footprint in Oregon, but get this, she will blame auto emissions as the problem for carbon in the atmosphere a few months from now, and the loony left Democrats will believe whatever Carbon Kate has to say. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, I want to hand out one Daily Grill today that has to do with a relatively small legal settlement. When I say small, when you see a number like $600,000 in a settlement, that is usually either a government agency or a private company saying it would cost us more to defend this in court than it does to just write a check. Still, I think in cases like this, they should have said, no way, we're not paying one thin dime. Consider this. A 24-year-old man by the name of Terrell Johnson, 4 years ago, was at a light rail station. His family says he was having a mental health crisis, so he was crazy, for which he unsuccessfully sought help from medical providers. Yes, but the important thing is, he threatened several people with a knife. The police were called, naturally enough. And when the police responded, Johnson decided to threaten the police officer with a knife, and the officer shot him. All of that sounds completely right. Does it sound right that a family would get a $600,000 settlement, even though they'll probably have to give a third of it to the lawyers, $400,000 because a crazy member of your family decides to pull a knife, threaten people, and then when a police officer shows up to get you to stop threatening people, you threaten the cop with a knife and you get shot? Does anybody deserve to win the lawsuit lottery for that kind of situation? As far as I'm concerned, the city should have said the killing of your son was entirely justifiable. He brought it on himself. He caused the situation, and we're not giving you a dime. But these days, city halls all over America and here in the Pacific Northwest just love to write checks. Now, our best email so far today. You can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online, rivercityusa.com/careers. Pat Ivers writes in, Lars, I've been wondering, is there any data out there that shows how many board feet of timber burns in the U.S. every year due to all the wildfires? Or are there even ballpark estimates of how many average board feet of timber there is per acre? I've been trying to get some stats and I can't. Pat, the short answer is that when a fire ripped through a forest, oftentimes you could salvage an awful lot of lumber out of those burned trees. The outside burns, the inside typically does not in most of the fires, but the environmentalists fight that as well. So you've got two things that are wasting all that wood: the fire that burns the outside and the environmentalist tree huggers who burn the rest of it and don't allow you to salvage it, which means it rots and all that carbon goes right back into the atmosphere if that's what makes you happy. To your calls now. Let's start with Romeo in Seattle. Hey, Romeo, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network on a Tuesday. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars. So I noticed that Portland, Oregon has a lot of problems with job deficiency. And I agree with you. I think we should start logging. I think that Kate Brown is incompetent, just like Joe Biden. And I think that if Kate Brown could ever find something useful to do, I think she should start putting jobs back in Portland. Instead of deciding to make Portland suffer and to make anybody suffer, we need more jobs in Oregon.
Well, why don't we have the private sector do it? Kate Brown doesn't know jack about jobs. She hasn't worked in the private sector. Thank God she can't be governor anymore because she's term limited out. So she has to leave at the end of this term. She'll get a very fat PERS pension for the rest of her life. But she, as far as I can tell, she knows absolutely nothing about creating jobs. On the other hand, if we made a commitment and we said we will make sure there is a steady stream of timber cut in federal and state forests over the next 20 years, there are plenty of private companies that would go out and build the mills and the capacity to mill all those trees into something useful and keep the carbon encapsulated if that's what matters to you. But they won't do it unless they can be assured of a steady supply. Coming up, he grew up in Oregon, left for about a half a century, made his home in big cities. Would this New York Times columnist make a great Northwest governor? Details and my take on Nicholas Kristof coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network. Happy Tuesday to you and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to have you on board and always glad to get your calls. And of course, naysayer calls go right to the head of the list at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter poll question today, and it sounds kind of strange, but I guess carpetbaggers are not all that strange in politics. Would a New York Times columnist make a good governor for any of the Northwest states? In this case, Nicholas Kristof is being talked about as a possible candidate for governor of Oregon. Now, he grew up here. In fact, I knew him in high school because I was a debater. I had a debate partner, and we would go to debate tournaments, and we would regularly meet up with Kristof and his partner, and we usually thrashed them pretty well. He wasn't that good a debater, but it turns out he's been a very good columnist, I guess at least for the New York Times. Now, you have to understand, the New York Times is the liberal Bible for America. Everything the New York Times says is right according to the liberals, and of course, they engage in a whole bunch of hypocrisy. They regularly criticize people for making public information that they themselves make public, things like that. But now, Nicholas Kristof, who has scored two Pulitzer Prizes writing a column for the New York Times, again, I can tell you I disagree with the column, but congratulations to him for winning the Pulitzer Prize. He told Willamette Week, and you know we have a good connection to Willamette Week. Again, I don't always agree with the folks at Willamette Week. But he said, we need new leadership from outside the broken political system. Now, Willamette Week said, presumably in straight face mode, sounding like a candidate, I'm honestly interested in what my fellow Oregonians have to say about that. So here's Nick Kristof, who's been part of the establishment. That is, he writes for one of the biggest, most liberal newspapers in America. And if you read his columns, and I read his columns, not every one of them, but I read them because I can see what a tried and true liberal believes, that he believes that he's coming in from the outside of a broken political system. Although most of what he writes about is about the political system that he and his fellow liberals support, both in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. So consider that this guy who's worked as a columnist, as a journalist, nothing wrong with that, I've done it myself, seems to think that he may have the stuff to be governor of a state. But for the most part, he hasn't lived in the state in almost half a century. I know that a lot of us have a childhood home. I mean, I was born in Taiwan. Would that make me a great governor of Taipei? I don't think so. But in this case, Christoph is talking about it. And he's got a lot of people talking because he has a big name. Now, it's pointed out he's covered an awful lot of issues here in the Pacific Northwest. One of them in particular I thought I'd mention because he actually wrote a column in which he appealed to people, help me find Donald Trump's anarchists in Portland. Well, most of us who live in the Portland metro understand it isn't hard to find those anarchists. They call themselves Antifa. They regularly engage in riots. They engage in arson. They engage in looting. They engage in some cases in assault and even murder. It was an anarchist who murdered a man on the streets of downtown Portland. It was anarchists who took over Capitol Hill in Seattle. So while the rest of us would have no problem whatsoever finding the anarchists, Nick Christoph, well, maybe he's the kind of guy who couldn't find his backside with both hands, a map, and a flashlight. But he actually wrote a column about he didn't understand what the problem was. He wasn't seeing anarchy going on in the Pacific Northwest, and in particular in Portland. Well, he is considering running in the Democrat primary for governor. I think this would be a disaster. Now, the liberals may love this guy, but I think that somebody who doesn't have any role in the private sector, never run a business. I understand that as a journalist, and especially if you do freelance pieces, you are a little bit of your own business. But that's different than running a good-sized enterprise with a lot of employees. People from the private sector, Nick Christoph doesn't think much of Donald Trump, but for the liberals, he would check that box. He's not Donald Trump. He is a liberal. In any case, Politico wrote it up. They said any bid for governor would most likely be difficult for an outsider, even one with local roots and a national media platform. At least six candidates, you heard from one of them, Bridget Barton, who's a conservative, who announced that she would run as one of the possible Republican candidates for governor. She announced on this program last week. We expect to have other candidates announce on this program as well. But there's the Speaker of the State House of Representatives, Tina Kotek, who doesn't exactly have a great track record. The State Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum, she's another possible candidate. A top union leader has already announced she may run. And Christoph effectively made his announcement in Willamette Week, which doesn't surprise me. It's a nice, comfortable place for a liberal to be, and you know they're not going to be too tough on him. He's 62 years old. He's covered the world. He married a woman that you know he had met through his work. He has connections to China. He has won Pulitzer Prizes for reporting on the Tiananmen Square protests in China and on genocide in Darfur. He's got a great professional catalog. Does he have the capability to make good decisions for an entire state? A state with a state workforce of 50,000 or so, a budget that runs close to $70 billion, where you have to not just sit down and think about a column you're going to write, where you write one or two or three columns a week and you give your opinion. You have to actually, as governor, make decisions. And in many cases, they are decisions that affect whether or not somebody is going to live or die. You, as governor, might be called upon to sign a death warrant for somebody to be executed. The death penalty is still officially on the books. You might be called upon to answer whether or not you're willing to send the National Guard when the state's biggest city is crippled by riots and looting and arson and murder. And you would have to make those decisions. It would be interesting to see what a Nick Christoph would do on the campaign trail if he actually got some tough questions. I'm not expecting that a liberal candidate for governor would get a lot of tough questions, but it's possible. It would be interesting to see him have and to say, because you grew up here, went to high school here, and still have connections here, friends, family, that sort of thing, does that give you enough connection, or does the fact that you've spent close to half a century living in big cities and dealing with big city media, is that more of a disqualifier against being able to understand the issues of a state like this? It'd also be interesting because Nick Christoph has written about the logging wars, about the environmentalism of the Northwest, and about the fact that the economy here over the last several decades has been devastated by the loss of jobs in fishing, in farming, in timber, and all these other industries, and then an awful lot of the West now is dominated by trade with Asia. and whether or not Asia would be an issue as well. I know that Nick Kristof, as I said, has had some real interesting connections as a journalist working in China. Be interesting to see what his point of view is on a country that even this week, we're going to tell you, has threatened to nuke Japan if Japan comes to the defense of the country of China. Be interesting to get Nick Kristof's take on that. I know he doesn't always write favorably about China. It might be nice to have a China critic who actually knows something about the country. But the idea of somebody coming back to his hometown or his home state and being able to run for governor of the state and then never having made more decisions than how long is my next column going to be or what is the what's the subject going to be, to see him running and saying he will make good decisions for a state that has more than its share of troubles, it would be very interesting. Be very interesting to see whether or not he could actually stand up to the kind of media questions he might get. Although, as I said, one of the advantages he has, a liberal running in a fairly liberal region with mostly liberal news media, he might get the kind of softball treatment from the media that would lead him to believe he actually could run the state. Well, Kate Brown thought she could run the state too, and you almost can't count the number of mistakes she's made just in the last year and a half or so. In any case, glad to be with you on a Tuesday, live on the Radio Northwest Network. Always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. Coming up, Taiwan's been a great friend of the United States, so is Japan, and now a major trading partner of ours, China, is threatening to nuke Japan if it comes to the defense of China or Taiwan. We'll talk about that coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Our Twitter poll today, would a New York Times columnist make a good governor for Oregon? I'd say no in this case. I happen to know the guy involved, Nicholas Kristof. I don't think much of his politics, but he's been very accomplished in the field of journalism, won the big awards, went to work for the biggest newspaper. He's now taken a leave of absence from the New York Times and now is at least talking about whether or not he'd run for the chief executive position of one of the Northwest states we serve on this network. And that's, of course, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We try to provide honestly provocative talk every single day of the week. And you're invited to the conversation at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our Twitter poll, @LarsLarsonShow, is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, last week's Twitter poll question, I took a couple of days off, actually went to the Seattle area. It's very pretty. Seattle is full of homeless people, Bellevue not so much, other parts of the state plus or minus depending, and we ran into a certain number of Karens because these days Karens are everywhere with the advent of masks and vaccines and everything else. Although you notice the mainstream media is not spending as much time talking about the five Democrats out of 50, the ones who took that private jet out of Texas so they could fly out of the state to Washington, D.C. to support a federal takeover of state elections. Five of the 50, all of them had been vaccinated. None of them wore a mask on the airplanes. Apparently, it was tougher to drink the beer they brought with them on the airplane if you're wearing a mask. But five of them have now come down with COVID. And now we hear today that at least one White House staffer and a staffer for Nancy Pelosi have come down with COVID, or they've been at least exposed to some of those Democrats who came to visit. Anyway, last week's question, if Idaho outlaws a workplace vaccine mandate, should Oregon and Washington do the same? Idaho is on its way to having a law against your employer telling you that you have to have the vaccine. Oregon and Washington, I think, should follow suit. I doubt they will, but they should. 82% of you voted yes in that question. I voted yes as well. 18% of you voted no. And again, you can find the question both on Twitter at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com on our website, blissfully free of the kind of censorship that Twitter and Facebook and the rest engage in. As I said, I always like to tell you if I have a dog in the fight on a particular question. In this case, I like the country of Taiwan, and not just because I was born there about 62 years ago, but because Taiwan has been a great friend to the United States. It is a very pro-capitalist, pro-democracy country, almost the polar opposite of what mainland communist China is. But it's a little island nation. There are about 24 million people who live on that little slice of land, and they are tremendously productive in electronics, in agriculture, and everything else. In fact, they could give a lot of states here in the Northwest a run for the money when it comes to technology, when it comes to agriculture, and the rest. And when I was born there 62 years ago, the place was very much a third world country. Today, it is very much in the first world. So, what happens when Japan says to China, if you decide to threaten Taiwan, as they've been for a long time, that China responds by threatening to nuke Japan? I'm not exaggerating. There is a now-deleted propaganda video in which the Chinese government threatened to nuke Japan following comments by Japanese leaders who had vowed to defend Taiwan from a Chinese invasion, which you say, well, China's going to invade Taiwan? Yeah, they threatened to do it and have been for decades. It's a six-minute video which was posted to the Chinese Communist Party-sanctioned channel called Jigua, that featured images and videos of Chinese war machines, tanks, and fighter jets edited into pictures of a devastated 1940s Japan following the World War II U.S. nuclear strikes on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The video had 2 million views before it was finally deleted from the internet. Again, something put up by the Chinese Communist government. It has since been posted, reposted on YouTube and partially on Twitter, where it was translated with English subtitles. The video references Japan's defeat in World War II before promising, quote, full-scale war against the only country to have ever been nuked. The video also said there will be no peace talks. And let me read you a quote from it. When we liberate Taiwan, if Japan dares to intervene by force, even if it only deploys one soldier, one airplane, or one ship, we will not only return reciprocal fire, but we will also start a full-scale war against Japan. We will use nuclear bombs first. We will use nuclear bombs continuously until Japan declares unconditional surrender for the second time. This is the message coming from the Chinese Communist government. It says, what we want to target is Japan's ability to endure a war. As long as Japan realizes that it cannot afford to pay the price of a war, it will not dare to rashly send troops to the Taiwan Strait. Now, wouldn't you think that an awful lot of companies here in the Pacific Northwest that do business on a regular basis with Communist China would say, if you're going to threaten another country with nuclear annihilation, to bomb continuously with nuclear weapons against Japan, if you're going to do that, we want nothing to do with you. Well, of course, you understand Nike, one of the Northwest's bigger companies, has already said we are of China and for China. That was the comment of its CEO. Don't expect them to come to the defense of Taiwan. And other companies that do a huge amount of business with the mainland Chinese communists, they're not going to say a word. They want to make sure that they are held in good favor by the Chi Com government. Coming up after the news, the Northwest has plenty of ineffectual Democrats in Congress. Coming up next, a young lady who might just replace one of those ineffectual Democrats with some real conservatism. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your calls. If you want to take part in the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here Monday through Friday, every single day. And on Fridays, we celebrate First Amendment Friday. Our Twitter poll today, would a New York Times columnist who grew up in the Northwest make a good governor for Oregon? I'd say no to the idea of Nicholas Kristof. You can answer any way you like at Lars Larson Show, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. You might notice during the summer months, especially as we head up to an election year next year, you might notice that we spend a lot of time with candidates. That's because I want to hear about the candidates and hear from the candidates who are going to run for office in Oregon and Washington and Idaho. And one of them is Lori Chavez de Remer. She's a former mayor of a small town and wants to run as a candidate for Congress to replace the less than effectual Kurt Schrader, who's been in Oregon's 5th Congressional District for a time. Ms. Chavez de Remer, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lars. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be back on your show.
Very good. You're not on a speakerphone, are you, by any chance?
I can't be off of it.
No, we want you to be off the speakerphone. I think the producers usually say that because it sounds like you're coming from the bottom of a well, and we want people to hear your actual voice. So if you could fix that.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now. So tell me this.
Perfect.
You want to run for Congress, but I noticed that part of your campaign statement is about local issues, things like policing and crime and riots and things like that. Help me understand that you want to represent the Northwest in Congress, not in a city council or in the legislature.
Sure. Well, I think the issues are the same, don't you? Whether we're representing
no, I don't.
20, well, if you're asking 25,000 people or 700,000 people, it's what affects us on the ground. And as my tenure as mayor, we address those, yes, on a smaller scale. But when we translate that or extrapolate that into our daily lives, what do we care about in D.C. that we need to bring home to Oregon? That's jobs in the economy, safety and security, our children's education, our rights to our freedoms, and that's what I want to take to Washington and let them know that Oregon matters, Oregon needs a voice, and it can come from a small-town girl as well as it can come from a big city guy.
I'm not faulting, let's hope it's not Nicholas Kristof for governor, but I'm not faulting you for wanting to solve those problems. It's just that schools are, for the most part, locally funded and locally decided. Policing is locally funded and locally decided. And so I worry when people say, I want to run for Congress, and then I want to fix the schools. And I say, well, the fix is here, not back on Capitol Hill. And the same thing for police and a lot of other issues. Now, there are issues that I think can only be addressed by the Congress, but those are not some of them. And that's my honest answer. And I want to make sure that, that's where you're going with this as well, because otherwise you can go to Congress, you can talk a lot about policing of cities, but the decisions for the most part about policing of cities are made in city councils, county commissions, and at the state legislature, not on Capitol Hill.
Sure. Passed down through the national agenda, right? So when we're talking about funding schools, it's our taxpayer dollars that will go to D.C. and eventually come back. When we're talking about what the agenda is on the national level about what they're teaching in our schools, I think that that's where my voice can be heard from what I've heard here on the ground in Oregon. You know, when you're talking about Congress and what the role is, yes, they make laws. Yes, they declare war. Yes, they talk about public dollars and oversee that expenditure. No different than we do on the ground in local cities. So while we can do investigations and approve the presidential agenda, and right now what we're seeing is the presidential agenda is not benefiting the people of Oregon. So
I agree. What do you plan to get done if you get the nomination to run as the Republican, and if you beat Kurt Schrader in the general election next year? What do you plan to get done first?
Yeah, depending on where these lines are drawn, isn't it? You know, it's very difficult for us to decide when we're getting in this game and when we're not. But stepping into the game is important, whether the lines are drawn or not. So I want to represent the citizens of Oregon and Congressional District 5 or possibly 6 where those lines are drawn. But I'm telling you, our freedoms are what's at stake for me. And talking to business owners and talking to parents and talking to anybody that I can talk to, our freedoms are at stake here. And that concerns me a great deal. You know, I just recently read an article in the Wall Street Journal talking about, you know, anti-capitalism and what that means and what's being destroyed. And it concerns me if we don't identify what those things are, right? We're hurting the economy, our southern borders at stake that we're seeing come across. We're talking about censorship and the cancel culture, and we can't speak out anymore. And why is it the defunding of the police movement is okay to accept? Because respect for authority for me is important. Respecting our law enforcement is important. And it's all those things that we have to address. And with COVID-19 and what's coming out of the economy, you know, and start to see the uptick and then start to see on TV that we are going to be shut down again, possibly with more mask mandates not letting our kids back in schools. People should be aware of that. And we're seeing it across the nation. We're seeing school boards. We're seeing parents rise up and say, enough is enough. And I want to stand in front of them, behind them, and next to them and say the same for Oregon.
Well, let me ask you about something specific. Right now, the biggest problem that businesses have is hiring workers. And the reason they have that problem is that the Congress funds the unemployment fund, but the states run it. Would you, as a member of Congress, say we should cut off the extra monies that are being paid out to people to sit at home and do nothing instead of looking for jobs?
Right. Well, small businesses are in direct competition with our government. When we pay out $300 checks to the tune of $1.8 trillion for people to sit on their couch and do nothing, I would think that that was a problem for small business. We have built America on small businesses, and now we're in direct competition with them to pull these workers from them. You can see the supply chains. You can see in grocery store lines. So when you say, is it happening on the ground? Go to your local grocery store and see that the shelves are still somewhat empty. And it isn't because, that's not being provided. It's you go ask the store clerk and they'll say, we don't have enough workers to come in here and put it on the shelves. They're yep. tired of working 21 days by themselves, and they can't not only order it, they can't put it on the shelf. So there's the problem, and they're not wanting to go back to work.
Would you as a member of Congress say,
when I hear young people say, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to have this degree, but I'm a little disenfranchised in the fact that I'm not really sure it's going to be worth it. I'm not sure it's going to be worth it to work this hard because, one, the government's going to take my money, and two, you know, I can just live this casual life and I don't have to work that hard. We're disenfranchising our young people.
Lori, we're almost out of time. Where can people find you on the web?
LoriChavezDreamer.com.
Very good. Lori, good luck to you. We'll look forward to talking to you again, and I very much appreciate you coming on the program. Coming up in a moment, inflation hits our country and this region with a vengeance. But Joe Biden, who's never had a private sector job in his life, claims he can beat inflation by, get this, by spending a lot of borrowed money. I'll give you that crazy explanation coming up next and get to your phone calls and emails. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. We've got a naysayer on hold. I want to get right to him. But let me mention this. This just seems so cockamamie, I almost can't imagine it. We've seen inflation jump dramatically. I told you that in the month of June, that month alone, consumer prices went up 0.9%, meaning that if prices, consumer prices, go up at that rate, at the June rate for the next year, inflation will go up 10%. Now, that's not likely. But what we have seen is a year-over-year increase in consumer prices of about 5.5%. So it may be that it'll be worse than 5.5%, maybe not as bad as 10%, but we're seeing dramatic inflation. Used cars are selling for dramatically more. Gasoline is almost 50% above where it was a year ago. And I think we know who to blame. So what does Joe Biden do? Joe Biden has said that if he can only spend $4 trillion in borrowed government money, flush that money into the economy, that will hold inflation down. Now, maybe Joe Biden cheated his way through Econ 101. I don't know. And I'm happy to be set straight if one of you is an economist and can tell me, how is it that if the government flushes trillions of dollars of borrowed money into an economy, that is going to hold inflation in check? But that's exactly what Joe Biden says. He says, our experts believe, and the data shows, that most of the price increases we've seen are expected to be temporary. Experts? Where? Who is saying it's going to be temporary? The White House Budget Office had forecast inflation for this year at 2.1%. It's now running at more than double that. So when Joe Biden says, well, we got experts that say it's only going to be around for a little while and we can hold it down by having the government spend trillions of dollars borrowed from, well, Treasury bill borrowing, printing money, things like that, that's going to hold down inflation? I thought Econ 101 said that if you took any economy and flush a whole bunch of money into it, inflation results. And then when you pay people not to work, which forces employers to have to raise the amount they offer to get workers on the job, and they're having a tough time getting workers on the job even with higher paychecks, that Joe Biden seems to think this is going to be temporary, even though his own White House said, oh, no, we're going to have 2% inflation this year. Oh, it's 2.5 times that much? Oh, sorry, our mistake, but it's only going to be temporary. It'll probably go away in a while. This sounds so crazy, I can't believe it. In any case, we always promise to put naysayers first. So let me go to John, who's listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, John, welcome to Tuesday on the Lars Larson Show. What do you and I disagree about today?
Well, I don't think we've been that good a friend to Taiwan, and here's my point on that. I don't know. I think it was either the Clinton administration or it might have been the Reagan administration forcefully stopped Taiwan's nuclear weapons program. And I think that made it much more dangerous to the island nation. And then, of course, renouncing them as a nation. And I think
we have not renounced them.
Well, we don't call them China, but we call them Taiwan. Hold on.
There are two different countries. There's mainland China, that's the communists. There's Taiwan, which is the Republic, People's Republic of China. There's the PROC, and there's the Republic of China. They're two different countries.
Isn't it basically an extension of Sun Yat-sen's mainland China? Anyways, to make the island nation safer, I think we need to have tactical nukes and Iron Dome missile systems placed on the island.
You think that's what we need? Because I actually think we've been a very good friend to Taiwan. Number one, we trade with Taiwan to a tremendous degree, although I wish we'd shift even more of our business to Taiwan.
What's their position on us stopping their nuclear weapons program forcefully?
There appears to still be a Taiwanese nuclear weapons program.
I know, but America's done everything they could to slow it down.
I'm sure that within the idea of non-proliferation, which is the idea that we only have a certain number of countries on this planet that are armed with nuclear weapons, and the non-proliferation agreements of the bigger nuclear armed powers have attempted to try to make sure that we don't end up with more and more countries that have nuclear weapons. But if you were Taiwan, hold on. If you're Taiwan and you're a tiny little island and you're being threatened on a regular basis by the massive government of the communist government of mainland, and they keep saying, if you elect the wrong person, we'll attack your island, we'll invade your island, we'll take your island back. Why shouldn't they have the biggest, best weapons they can get? We sell them weapon systems. The United States does. I think that's act of a good friend.
I think we've got another step up, though, the way China's talking to Japan, don't you think?
Do we have another step up of what?
Escalation. Didn't China just threaten to nuke?
China allowed a video to be posted. It's now been taken down, but of course, anything you post on the internet is there forever. So it's been reposted. And what happened was when Japan said, if China tries to invade Taiwan, we will defend Taiwan. And China's official response, put up as a video, was if Japan defends Taiwan, we will attack Japan with nuclear weapons. Yeah, that was a step up by the communist Chinese, which is why I wish we'd do less and less business with mainland China. They're a nasty country.
I don't even think Biden could find the football myself.
Well, I don't think so either, but I'm not quite sure what that means. I think China Joe is owned lock, stock, and barrel by the Chinese communists because they paid off his family to the tune of millions of dollars through son Hunter, who promised to share the money that he got, about $10 million that he got from Chinese business interests tied to the government. He gets $10 million, and what did he get it for? His charming personality, his cocaine habit, his fatherless children? No, he got it because his dad was vice president at the time, and I think the Biden family owes a lot to the Chinese communists. We have a president who's owned lock, stock, and barrel by the Chinese, and he's going to stay loyal to them.
I think Hunter owes 40 years in a max prison to the U.S. at this time.
I'm not sure what that means, but I've been trying my best to understand what you're saying. John, I appreciate the call. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarsen.com. I have to tell you something. The comments I got back from people about my comments that the Pacific Northwest is on fire this year. It was on fire last year. We've had a tremendous number of fires. And we've come to accept it that every single summer we're going to see hundreds of thousands of acres burn. I mean, the typical fire season for Oregon is somewhere around a few hundred thousand acres. In a really bad year, 1 million acres catches fire and burns. And I keep asking people, this is a choice. Why don't we choose to say we're going to go in and we're going to harvest the trees as we once did? And then we're going to replant them, which is, by the way, required by law. Instead, what we get is people saying, well, this is just the norm. Or they say it's because of global warming. Oh, by the way, Kirk writes, enlarged, the environmentalists argue to leave the trees and let them all rot because it's natural. What they forget is that when they rot, they produce more harmful greenhouse gases than if they were burned and primarily made CO2 into the air. And he's absolutely right about that. And Greg writes in from Malott, Washington, Lars, I live just outside of OMAC, and our visibility is about a mile, maybe 2 miles max. The fires are out of control for the last 30 years. It's all part of the liberal plan. I used to spend so much time up there since the 1970s, I never remember continuous fire seasons every year. This crap started around 2000, so they can blame global warming. There's no difference than what they would do purposely to screw up traffic up and down the I-5 corridor, create congestion, and blame the taxpayers while blowing money collected for roads on worthless projects. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday. Coming up in a moment, American hero Colonel Oliver North joins me next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I love talking to you, but one of the great pleasures of this job, I have to admit, is the fact that it affords me the opportunity to talk to the greats, the real heroes out there, like Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, United States Marine Corps, retired, and now the author of a book that comes out tomorrow, We Didn't Fight for Socialism, America's Veterans Speak Up. Colonel, welcome back to the program.
Lars, always great to be with you out there in the People's Democratic Republic.
I got to tell you something. The crazy, and you're right. I live in Crazy Town. But yeah. What do we do about this? And how in the world did socialism take on such a, a great persona in this country, as opposed to being people saying, I don't want to be I don't want to live in a socialist country. This is shared misery, as I think Lady Thatcher said it.
Well, in fact, she's right. And, of course, she knew East Germany to be another one of those failed states. The whole experiment with Marxism was one that used to divide people by economic class. I mean, that was their argument from the 1800s all the way through the Russian Revolution, all the way through what's going on right now in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. And what you apparently have in the Congress of the United States and a willing co-conspirator named Biden is an effort to do the same kind of thing here. And so in all the guys that I covered during the war, and I probably close to 10,000 maybe in 64 embeds that I did over that 17-year period, I kept hearing the same kind of thing from these guys. They were concerned, particularly in the Obama regime, of the kind of concerns that we put in this book, but quite frankly, they now see, since November 3rd, that America was at a crossroads. And on November 3rd, one path led to a revival of, if you will, the founder's vision for our country, where individual liberty and self-determination, personal responsibility, equal opportunity, all of which, by the way, takes place in our military, because it's a meritocracy.
Yeah.
It's not based on race. It's not based on color. It's not based on anything except how well you do the job that you've been given and how well you treat the people for whom you're responsible. And the other path, of course, led to socialism, which is where we're headed right now. And that's a philosophy that leads, as we've just vividly seen in Cuba, to tyranny, corruption, and despotism. And it's been that way everywhere it's been tried. You know, I think what's happened now is that after decades of progressive indoctrination of our educational institutions, our so-called mainstream media, socialist advocates have finally hoodwinked half of the American electorate into believing their false promises. And that's where we are today.
I'm talking to Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, whose brand new book comes out tomorrow. We Didn't Fight for Socialism, America's Veterans Speak Up. Well, you speak about high school classes. I had a class once that invited me to speak to them, and they were mixed. I mean, there were a bunch of people in there that were liberals, and that was okay. I said I wanted to take questions, but I wanted to ask them a question. I said, how many of you have a 4-point grade average? And I got a bunch of hands. It was a smart group. And and I said, okay, you guys we'd been talking about socialism. I said, how many of you with 4 points would be willing to take a 3-point instead and share that extra grade point with all the kids in this, if there are any in this room, who have a D average, so you can haul them up to a C? Because that's socialism to a T. I got half a dozen hands of smart young people with 4-point grade averages saying, I will share my 4-point and take a 3 instead and bring the D kid who didn't hit the books up to a C, a passing grade.
Well, that does prove the effectiveness of the indoctrination, because that's what's going on in our schools today. I mean, when these guys who put their lives on the line, who can, the real people, the contributors to this book, all that David Goetsch and I did was basically document what they were saying. And he had two U.S. Marines writing a book, believe it or not. And what you've got is a summary from every branch of the armed forces. It looks at every aspect of our culture, and it focuses on, we didn't fight for socialism is the number one thing that these guys were now saying. I mean, if you go to chapter one of the book, it starts in the 1960s. Our educational system, particularly our colleges and universities, infiltrated by Marxist ideologues on a mission. These were the people who were burning their draft cards while I was getting shot at, right? I mean,
yep.
And now they're running the classes, the schools, the educational system. The anti-war movement, the anti-military movement, the anti-American movement that burned ROTC offices. You and I remember these days. ROTC offices all across the country. The Vietnam Veterans Against the War, the SDS. And their heroes are people like John Kerry, who lied before Congress, and Jane Fonda, for lying about how the POWs were being treated. Those who burned the draft cards on the mall in D.C., while my Marines were being shot at and hit by enemy fire, are now in control of education at all levels in America. And quite frankly, we've got one last chance to fix it. Because if November 3rd last year was the turning point, the next chance, and maybe the last chance we have to fix it, is 2022.
So tell me this, Colonel. How do we fix it? Because if you've got a whole generation indoctrinated, how do you unindoctrinate them?
Well, I think what you got to do is make sure that you get enough veterans of this war. One of the commercials that was on while I was listening to it is a war veterans organization. And I would hope that within those war veterans organizations there are people, young people, who are willing to run for public office. You don't have to run for president of the United States. I mean, we got a guy there who's totally incompetent right now, and he's president of the United States.
Okay.
Start out with a school board. Start out with a county board of supervisors. Start out with a city council. I mean, and I'm not trying to pick on you just because you're on the left coast and we're friends, right? But
yep.
You look at Seattle or Minneapolis or Portland or any one of those places that are dominated by the left and look at the consequences of it. I mean, remember the defund the police movement?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, holy mackerel.
Still going.
Well, it is still going. And the fact is, in every one of those major cities that are governed or misgoverned by liberal, these aren't Democrats in the old school. These aren't Democrats like the ones I knew growing up. These are people who are actually card-carrying anti-American people. And what they're doing is the defund the police movement has skyrocketed crime. You now have police departments universally across the country that are undermanned, underfunded, and underperforming. And everybody's shocked that there's an increase in violent crime? How could you be surprised at that if you put less police out there, you target the police, you start firing rockets at them night after night after night in places like Portland? I mean, what do you expect? And that's why these guys who put their lives on the line, you know, serving our country, some in multiple tours, I mean, many of them, are now saying, I'm not so sure I want my kids serving in the military.
That's, no, and,
that's
and
not
those
a good thing for our country.
And, Colonel, those are the guys and gals who came back with the promise, hey, you served your country, go to school for 4 years. It's on us. But you've got other kids in America saying, I went out and spent a bunch of money on a degree that wasn't worth anything. Could somebody please pay the tab for me? And they're being taken seriously.
Well, they are. There's legislation in the Congress of the United States to do exactly that. And that's part of the false promises of what you get out of socialism. I mean, what the socialists in our government are doing today has been typical of socialists since the whole idea was invented. Deceiving people, distorting the message, dividing the people, and destroying the institutions that led us to where we are. I mean, this is not a bad country. This
No.
is a wonderful country. Why are people putting their lives at risk trying to get here? I mean, the idea of what's behind America is what inspires the rest of the world. It's interesting because the far left is saying that the embargo that was put in place on various items by the previous administration is what's causing the problem in Cuba. That's not true. The fact is the Cuban people aren't rioting, burning the American flag in front of our embassy.
No, they're actually waving the American flag. Colonel Oliver North, great friend of the program. His new book is called We Didn't Fight for Socialism, America's Veterans Speak Up. Colonel, thank you so much. Coming up in a moment, some of that violent crime and a dozen people shot over a single weekend. We'll talk about it coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. As you know, the Pacific Northwest is on fire again. Governor Kate Brown held a news conference today, and I just read through the comments that she made at the news conference. It was happening while we were on the air. But she literally says, have a kit ready to leave your home when we tell you to leave your home. That's her idea of preparedness. Not clearing a defensible space around your home if you happen to live in a place that's got a lot of trees and might catch fire. She talked a lot about global warming and climate change and drought and things like that. But as far as preparation, her idea of preparation is have a change of clothes in a bag and all your important personal papers and be ready to leave your home when the government tells you to leave your home and then just run. No other preparation than that. And that seems kind of inadequate to me. To your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS, and welcome to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. Our Twitter poll today, would a New York Times columnist make a good governor for the state of Oregon? In this case, it's Nicholas Kristof, who has spent most of his adult and career life outside the Northwest. He's taken a leave from the great New York Times as a columnist, and he's being talked about as a possible Democrat candidate. I don't know what in the world. It would be great to be able to talk to him. He has been on this show, but it's been at least 20 years since the last time he was on. But it'd be interesting to see what he has to say about what he would offer up in the way of solutions for the state's problems, because that's what the governor has to do. Respond to emergencies and develop solutions for a really large, I mean, you think about the size of the state of Oregon, the number of people who live here, and you look at the bad models like Jay Inslee and Kate Brown, Jay Inslee in Washington State, Kate Brown in Oregon, and you say, could you do the job adequately? And if so, let's test you by asking you a few questions about how you'd solve some of the problems that confront the state. Jay Inslee can't do it, but he got reelected. Kate Brown hasn't been able to do it. She got reelected. Now she's term limited out, thank goodness. And now we've got a possibility of a newspaper columnist from New York City. So at least he'll have something in common with one of the Northwest congressional delegation. Ron Wyden, U.S. Senator, makes his home in New York City, but says he represents Oregon. I suppose Nicholas Kristof couldn't be any worse. Let's go to Chris. Hey, Chris, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I was calling in for the first time, and heard you in the past couple days or weeks mention your opinion on the fires here in Oregon. I was hoping you could maybe reiterate for me so I can refresh on how you would approach with these fires being so rampant in Oregon.
I would approach it by looking at what has worked before. For 30 years, from the mid-50s to the mid-80s, we had one large fire in almost a third of a century. And you say, what was going on that would have affected fires? Well, we were aggressively logging, cutting trees down, sending them off to the mill, making things out of them, lumber, among other things, and then replanting the land. Did that work out well? Yes, it worked out great. Big jobs or good jobs, family wage jobs, revenue for the government, money to spend on other forest management like clearing and thinning and that sort of thing that would keep down the risk of fire. We also built a lot of roads that were paid for, in effect, by the taxpayer because they were part of the deal. If you were a timber company, the Forest Service would say, you can log that area that you put the bid in on, but you will pay the tax, you'll pay the U.S. Treasury this, you'll pay this to the cities and counties, and you'll build roads to our specification. Those roads are not only great for recreation, hunting, fishing, and every other use of the public forest that we all own, but they're also great for getting to a fire if there's a fire. You know what the Forest Service has been doing for the last 20 years? Destroying those roads. Not just letting them fall apart, but actively going in and destroying the roads so the access that would let you put the fires out is no longer there. And you're no longer cutting, which means you're not taking down older stands of timber and then taking all the trash that builds up on the forest floor, which is limbs and branches. Sometimes there is feet of dry material that will burn like crazy. And if you go in and log an area and then clear that, slash, and either grind it up, put it back into the ground, that's done in some cases, or burn the slash in the fall, and then plant brand new trees. You got a brand new forest. And we could cut another 5 or 6 billion board feet per year and literally never run out of trees. Does that outline the solution?
Yeah, I mean, my only take on that is, so I grew up cutting my own wood, growing up to all those logging sites. That's how we heated our house in the wintertime.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'm familiar with those, all those slash and, you know, how much timber is left on those logging sites that are clear cut. I know that there's some regulations in regards to how many trees need to be left standing.
For birds and things like that, yeah.
I can't cite that. But, you know, I wish I could cite this article that I was reading.
What are you trying to say? Just tell us what you got out of the article.
Well, basically, clear-cutting trees and replanting one single growth of trees is quite hazardous to fires, and it's what it
I think that's baloney.
A lot of
that's baloney. If you think that's true, I suggest you chat with Weyerhaeuser. Weyerhaeuser has monoculture, meaning they got the same species of tree growing on hundreds of thousands of acres. How often do you hear about Weyerhaeuser's forest going up in flames?
Probably because they cut them every 15 years.
No, 15. Closer to 35 to 50. But the point is, okay, they manage their property. I'll bet you take good care of your house. If you don't take good, you see any houses in your community that people don't take care of? What happens to them?
Yeah.
They fall apart. Guess what happens to a forest that you don't take care of? Now, private lands, very well maintained, very few fires. Public lands go up in flames every single summer, and this year, hundreds of thousands of acres of forests burning, and we own those forests, and they're badly managed. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday, and I'm glad to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. Always glad to get your calls as well. We endeavor to make this the best conversation in talk journalism, meaning we mix some facts and some opinions. You get some of both from me, and you're invited to take part at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Would a New York Times columnist make a good governor for a state? There's a name being talked about, Nicholas Kristof, winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes. He's a thoroughgoing liberal, and he has spent most of his life either living overseas or somewhere outside of the state of Oregon. But now he's being talked about as a possible candidate for governor because I guess he's sufficiently liberal and all that. I would say no. I happen to know the guy from decades ago. He wasn't a very good debater either. But having said that, would a New York Times columnist make a good governor for a state? I'd say no. You can vote any way you like at Lars Larson Show. And brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. I feel inclined to remind you, as I do occasionally when we have candidates on, I love talking to candidates because I want to see what they plan to do if they seek an office, a public office, at almost any level. School board is my favorite recommendation because I think average citizens can get a lot of things done there. Some run for the legislature. Some run for the United States Congress. Derek Ford is running for mayor in a small town. Derek, I'm curious what you plan to do if you get the job. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on today, Lars. You know, I'm a small-town business guy. I grew up in Southern Oregon and moved out to Washougal with my wife about 4 years ago. We opened up a restaurant out here, and I've just kind of seen the whole area just kind of very much stalling. We live in a beautiful community out here, and we have absolutely no economic growth. And even recently, I've tried to put another business within the city, and it's been just hurdle after hurdle. Well, I just finally got to the point and said, hey, I'm done doing it. You know, Washougal is not a good place for business. So 6 months ago, I was sitting down with some other business people, and I said, what can we do to try to make it a little bit more business friendly out here? And they said, you know, it's the business people like us that should be running for office and trying to get change in here, but we don't have the time. And then that's when we all kind of looked at each other, and a big light bulb went off, and we said, you know what, we got to get involved. So that's why I'm running for mayor right now. I just want to get a different set of eyes on that city council and see if we can make some change.
Well, Derek, I applaud all of those motivations. I mean, I get frustrated when I talk to candidates who don't seem to know what the job they're running for actually does, whether it's a legislature, Congress, or whatever. You seem to know exactly what the mayor's position is. He's to be the leader of a city. Now, in your case, running for mayor of Washougal, One of the things that strikes me as kind of funny is that if somebody asked me on paper, where do you find the biggest barriers to running a business, I'd say, well, the biggest cities usually have the biggest barriers, and the small towns are often a lot more friendly. What do you think went wrong in Washougal?
I think we just have a very liberal city council that's wanting to not explore growth. I have businesses all over Oregon in large cities, Hillsborough, Gresham, Eugene. You know, they all have their challenges, but out here, everybody just doesn't realize we're kind of at the end of the road out here before entering the gorge. We have an amazing opportunity to make Washougal just such a tourist destination and give the residents of, you know, almost 17,000 people a place to work. They don't want to look forward to the next 15, 20 years. They want to kind of keep exactly where we're at right now.
Okay, not to put words in your mouth, but is this the kind of view of people who say, I moved here to Washougal. I want it to stay exactly the same way, like it's a Norman Rockwell painting. You put hang it on the wall, and it stays the same. And 20 years from now, it will look and sound and feel the same way as it does today. I understand there are people who like the status quo, which is good for some people, depending on where you are in your life, not so good for everybody else.
Yeah, we have a great community right next door, Camas, Washington, and you know, they've done a great job with their downtown and economic development. Washougal is in the exact same position. We're just 5-10 years behind them. We just need to get on that train and start pushing for businesses to be revitalized and making it easier for people to come in and make this their home and put business up to keep people within our community from going to Camas or going into downtown Vancouver or downtown Portland.
Well, in fact, every business has kind of a life cycle, right? I mean, there are businesses that seem to have been around forever, but I can also count a number of businesses, even Bezos, you know, the guy who just, you know, went into space today.
Yeah.
He and I don't like his politics at all, just to be clear, but he even said, look, I can see the day where Amazon will not be the kind of, you know, gigantic dominant business it is today, which I think is kind of smart, because anybody who says, oh, you know, the Ford Motor Company will always be here and Sears will always be here and Kmart will always be here. Well, I got to tell you something. They have a life cycle. And if they don't bring in new things to a community and you just say, oh, all the old traditional businesses, they'll always be here, that's probably not going to work out well.
No, it absolutely isn't. And small businesses are the backbone of our country and our community. And I can just tell you right now from my personal experience that I'm established or going through right now, it's been extremely difficult, not only with all the handouts they're getting from the government, but just from all the regulations and taxes that is being burdened upon us. It's difficult. So anything that a city leaders or any state leaders or anybody elected official can do to make running businesses and opening businesses easier, you know, that's what, in my belief, needs to get done.
Derek, where can people go online to find out more about your campaign?
ElectDerekFord.com or on Facebook at Derek Ford for Mayor.
Now, let me ask you this. If you become mayor, you're going to have to go to the city council. If you have a brilliant idea and say, this will make things better, are you going to have to get 4 or 5 or 6 votes to be able to get that through? And if so, what are you going to try first?
Well, out here in Washougal, we're a weak mayor city, so literally position one of the city council is the mayor position. So yes, we need to work collaboratively as the council to try to push anything through. You know, it's going to be, I'm the only one having to go through a primary right now. We got a couple other positions coming open in the fall where they're not primarying, and there's some good conservative candidates that are kind of in line with my thought. So it's just going to be getting people on this board and kind of changing out the old guard to get things moving in the right direction. The first kind of thing for me is taking a look at the city books. I kind of got a little bit of a spending problem out here where we just spent $518,000 on community garden where our city manager is telling us it's not even going to be permanent.
$500,000 for a community garden? I thought that was where you went to a business and said, can we use your empty lot here and we'll go in and do some sweat equity and you get it for almost nothing.
Exactly. I mean, my wife and I, we even put a garden in there when we were told by the city that it was all paid for by grant money. And then when I met with the city manager, he said, yes, it was $80,000 paid for by grant money. And 2 days later, he's emailing me, telling me, you know what, Derek, I'm sorry, that's not 100% true. That came out of the funds from the city. And then a city worker approached me and said, Derek, you're not asking the right question. You're not asking how much they paid for the lot and how much they paid for the demolition. So total, it was $518,000.
In a small town to get a... Now, if every one of your streets and every one of your sidewalks was in perfect repair and all the other city services were running like a top, maybe you can afford an extra $500,000 for something else. But, Derek, thank you so much. We'll look forward to your victory and your becoming the mayor of Washougal, Washington. Coming up, should Amtrak reopen a stop in Boise that's guaranteed to accrue a multi-million-dollar loss every single year? Get to that next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to be with you and always glad to get your calls. It's stories like this that I think should be such easy judgment calls on the part of government. The Idaho Statesman has the story, so credit to the fish wrapper. Boise's last passenger train service, Amtrak's Pioneer Run, between Salt Lake City and Portland, quit cutting across southern Idaho almost a quarter century ago. A bill in the U.S. Senate is calling on Amtrak to study the Pioneer route and three other abandoned passenger rail routes. Now, I always wonder if somebody's abandoned something, you think, well, there could be some value in it, but you're going to have to take a hard look at it. There was probably a good reason they abandoned it. They've now assigned it to a committee in Congress, chaired by who else? Washington Democrat Senator Maria Cantwell. Not exactly the sharpest tool in the shed. The bill would be a first step to bringing Amtrak back to Boise. Get this, the Boise City Council passed a resolution June the 8th supporting bringing Amtrak back. And you say, okay, bully for you. Senator Mike Crapo, Republican of Idaho, good guy, who's worked for two decades to restore the route, urged the Senate committee to endorse the study. A study about a decade ago said it would cost somewhere between $37 and $44 million a year to restore the Pioneer Run, depending on which route they take. The route would then lose an estimated $25 to $35.5 million a year after ticket revenues. So in other words, it's a hobby. I consider anything you put a lot of money into where you don't make that same amount of money back, if you make the same amount back, it's a nonprofit. But if you put $35 million bucks in on top of what the ticket revenue is, and you're guaranteed to lose that much money every single year with no light at the end of the tunnel, pun intended, with the trains, somebody tell me that makes sense. People say, but I love trains. I said, I love trains too. But if you love trains and they don't even break even, then that's a hobby. If you want to do a hobby, go ahead, do it on your own dime. You want to do it on the taxpayer's dime, it better at least break even. Let's go to Russ in Bellingham. Hey, Russ, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KGMI. What's on your mind today?
Thanks, Lars. And it's actually pronounced Bellingrad.
Bellingrad. Okay.
Calling a socialist.
You got it.
I actually wanted to call to kind of spread some good news for the listeners, to the workers in the company I work for, a private company, they rejected the Teamsters. They had a vote. Part of the company down in California, or Commifornia, voted to let the Teamsters negotiate for them. And it's a new company, so it's kind of, you know, it's too early. They provide good benefits and good pay, so there's no need for a union. But the workers in the Pacific Northwest rejected the Teamsters.
Even in Bellingrad? Even there, they rejected the Teamsters?
The workers, well, you know, truthfully, there's only about five employees up in the Bellingrad area, but a lot of them in Seattle and Portland and over in Spokane and Idaho. But the Pacific Northwest Union, or the Pacific Northwest employees rejected the Teamsters.
See, now that's the fantastic kind of news that you're not likely to see on the television or hear it on the radio or even read it in the local paper. Although, did it make the Bellingham paper, the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, or not?
Probably not. I know when the Teamsters were voted in down in California, it was on a lot of periodicals, or you know, kind of Medium and other. Periodicals we're covering that
and
one.
And maybe that's because the California operation a little bigger? Is that one reason it maybe got more attention or not?
Well, it's one of these new companies that's more like a technology company that provides a good service that, you know, founded in San Francisco, of all places, like all these companies do. But the workers up in the Pacific Northwest decided, no, you know what, we're better off. It's such a new company. And they're doing a good job to provide a fair wage and even raising those wages with the cost of living as well as benefits. But we decided we don't need it.
Well, I'm glad to hear the news because, Russ, I got to tell you, I've been in a union one time. I hated every minute of it. I didn't want to be in it. And my coworkers and I got together and we got rid of the union. We decertified. That was a long, torturous process. It took almost 2 years. And I always, every time I hear from somebody who's a total union believer, I say, I don't get this. First of all, you know, I typically ask people, maybe you've heard me do it. I'll say, are you the best guy at what you do? Whatever you do, welding or, you know, machine shop, whatever it happens to be. And you go, no, I'm not the best. Are you the worst one? No. But why then does the best person at that job make the same paycheck, you know, as the worst person at that job and the average person? And most of the time they can't explain it. They say, well, that's the idea of unions. I said, why would anybody say, I work a lot harder and produce a lot better than this guy or gal that I work with, but we both get paid the same hourly rate? Why would anybody think that's sensible unless you're a socialist, you know, who thinks, well, everybody should get paid the same, whether they're good or bad? And I've never met the person who isn't proud of what they do. Well, sometimes people say, I don't like my job. But if you say, you know, are you proud of the skills you have? Yes. Are your skills better than other people? Yes. Should you get paid more than other people who have inferior skills to yours? And at that point, the union people say, we should all make the same amount of money. And Russ, I can't wrap my head around that. It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense to me either, Lars. I knew from the minute they were talking union, I said, it's a bad idea, especially for a new company that's still, it's only 6 years old, it's still kind of moving off of venture capital funds. You know, a union would just kill it. Just because the union says, oh, yeah, we want more money, doesn't mean the company's going to have more money. And then they could end up like Hostess.
No, and the other thing is, Russ, when I worked in television, I wasn't a member of the union, but all the, you know, a lot of the crew, the people around the cameras and the recording machines and all that, they were all union. And I kid you not, there was a, you know, I did this show called Northwest Reports. It was a documentary. And we'd tape my segments of the show, you know, I think it was Thursday night. And I remember how maddening it was because we'd get everybody in place where they were supposed to be. And every camera operator and everybody in the booth was where they were supposed to be. We'd get all ready to go. I kid you not, every once in a while we'd hit this and they'd say, oh, 8:15 p.m., time for our break. I said, hold on. We've got maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes of work to do here. Everybody is where they're supposed to be. Everything is set up right. All the, you know, white balance is what they call when they, you know, they make the cameras work right and all that. And I say, and you're going to knock off at this point instead of just let's do the 15 minutes worth of work and then everybody can go on break. And no. And so everybody would walk away for 15 minutes. Then they'd come back and it wasn't instantaneous. They'd come back and they'd say, oh, got to reset my camera. I got to do this. I got to do that. And once you got everybody sort of lined up again, which took some time, then we could actually do it. And it used to drive me nuts. Why don't we just finish this? And then everybody take a break. Nope. Break comes at 8:15 in our union contract. And I remember thinking, it's the work rules that unions impose that can sometimes be just destructive to the bottom line. And if you destroy the bottom line, what do you think the company pays you out of? So if you cost the company money because of strict adherence to all those rules, not safety rules, but just rules for the sake of rules, and you destroy, I don't know, a couple of $1,000 by doing that, where do you think your next raise is going to come from if you make the company lose money while it's doing the job when it doesn't have to? Russ, thanks a lot for the call, and glad you're listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And you might think that when you hear the term infrastructure, that what they're talking about, whether it's Congress or your local state legislature, that they're talking about roads and bridges and freeways and highways and water mains and sewer mains and electric lines and things like that. But would you necessarily include illegal aliens in the definition of infrastructure, especially when it comes to the U.S. Congress? John Zadrozny knows all about that. He's the director of the Center for Homeland Security and Immigration at the America First Policy Institute. John, good to have you back on the program.
Hey, Lars. It's great to talk to you again. Thanks for having me back.
So did I get any of that wrong? The Biden administration is trying to define people who've crossed into our country illegally and are present in the country illegally as part of an infrastructure package for the Congress?
Well, in some ways, Lars, it's not incorrect because it is their future party infrastructure. This is about amnesty. You know, they are basically trying to import new voters because they can't win Americans' votes anymore, so they're just going to add people to the rolls. And it's kind of remarkable to me, in addition to the fact that it's just grotesquely obvious what they're doing, it's also proof that they know the American people don't support it. If you believe this is what the American people want, you do this as a standalone bill. You don't stuff it into what most Americans probably won't even realize is, you know, a bit of a trap. If anyone's even paying attention to this in the heartland, all they hear is infrastructure. They think roads and bridges, like you said. And so I think it's really going to be incumbent upon everyone to really talk about this, spread this around, make sure people are aware that this is happening. And again, if the Democrat Party and Joe Biden really thought this is what the American people wanted, they'd be trumpeting from the hills their new immigration bill, and they'd be talking about it going into the fall. I also, Lars, I kind of think this is a sign that they know their time is limited. In some ways, this has a feel almost of what President Obama did in 2009 and 2010 with Obamacare. Understood he had a limited window, that the American people were shifting, and he was willing to sacrifice a House chamber to pass a big initiative. And I think this is something that they're looking at to do, even if it means they lose the House and maybe even the Senate.
And they want to do this on a simple majority through what's called budget reconciliation. Explain the difference there and why they don't have to get to the magic 60 votes in the Senate.
So I was in the Senate, but I'm far from an expert on the rules here. But the basic premise is that with most pieces of legislation in the Senate, you have to clear the filibuster, which means basically that, or rather, you have to clear cloture. Sorry.
Yeah,
so
cloture.
That means that you need the 60 votes to agree to vote on the bill, which then allows you to do a majority vote. Now, I think it's primarily because you can't cripple. I guess the rules require they're lax when it comes to budgeting because they'd like to allow space to not cripple the ability of the federal government to operate if you can't get 60 votes to clear the cloture vote. So as a result, anything that has to do with spending is exempt. So I guess their thought is that they could squeeze an amnesty, they can justify it, and then they can get it into the simple majority territory. And unfortunately, even if every Republican votes against it, which I'm worried won't be the case, they still get the tiebreaker with Kamala. So,
John, just so people understand this, the Congress has made the rules so that spending money is easy, but actually passing laws is hard. Now, if you ask the average taxpayer, should the Congress make the rules so that spending is easy, what do you think the average, I guess, non-Democrat would say about making spending easy?
I think I'm on the same page as you are, sir. I think we should find a way to reverse that and make it harder to spend money. But they've clearly made the decision internally that they want to be able to do this. And you know, the reality is every Congress is a master of its own destiny. They get to change the rules as they go, and that's fine. And I think there are some circumstances where I think it makes sense where you don't necessarily want an emergency spending package to be held up, but this is not an emergency spending package. This is trillions of dollars of monopoly money slathered across the trillions of dollars we've already spent that we don't have.
Well, and John, would you mind reflect on this a bit? You're going to find one of the least sympathetic people here in terms of are you sympathetic toward members of Congress? But it really does kind of put them in a bind if you say, well, there's all this money in there, and a lot of the money is going to be going to your district, or in the case of a senator, to your state. And if you vote against the amnesty piece of it, the money doesn't happen. So even for conservatives and Republicans, they're going to say, great, I get to go home, and everybody's going to say, hey, how come you didn't vote for that? We needed the new dam, the new freeway, the new whatever it happens to be. And you said, because I wanted to keep from giving amnesty to illegal aliens. And they're going to say, yeah, that's great. We agree with you on that. But where's the money? So it kind of puts them in a bind unless they are a really solid conservative.
Yeah, that's probably true, Lars, except that this is where principle and willpower comes into play. And I think it really, I view that as a somewhat easy conversation. I would go back and say, look.
Well, I do too. I'm not in Congress.
Yeah, right. No. But I think even you or I, perhaps in Congress, we would be able to say, we basically go home and say, look, put us in charge and we'll pass a clean infrastructure bill and we won't play games with your money. But I think you're right. It is a little bit of a tough bind, but it requires a little bit of willpower and a little bit of articulation. And I think it could be done. The reality is, I think any member who thinks that they have to do this needs to realize that their future in office is in jeopardy if they vote for it, at least as a Republican.
Well, because you're right. I think the Democrat Party, I always call them undocumented Democrats, because they want to pretty up this really ugly thing that we're a generous country, we let 1 million people in legally every year, and a path for those people 5 years from now to become citizens if they want to. And then we have a bunch of people who jump the line, and you say, well, we have to do something for that. No, we don't. We could say, no, we're not going to do that. And if we do decide to do it as a country, which happened in 86, they always blame that on Reagan. But I always point out, Reagan only signed a bill that was passed by the United States Congress, and he called it one of the biggest mistakes he'd ever made. Are we about to see that same kind of mistake made again?
I hope not, but it's entirely possible that might happen. Really, this comes down to Republicans standing firm, and it's entirely possible that still may not have an impact, but it really comes down to what they want to do to send a message to the better way to say it, I think, is basically that I don't think that they are going to be able to vote for this and remain in their positions. And I think they have to realize that if they really do care about their voters, if they really do care about their voters' power, then this is a no-brainer, because I think that's another way to look at it, too. It's not just about dollars. We have to think about this in terms of voting power. So if you've got one party that just, I mean, you know, I've said, I think we might have even discussed this once. It turns out when you spend 50 years aborting children in the womb, you're short about 60 million voters. Yep. And so this is basically a way to go get the voters they no longer have because they murdered them for money. And so now they're basically going to add people to make up for that gap. And they're going to wash away the votes of other people who are actually U.S. citizens right now. So if they want an argument, take home the your vote will be diluted by this bill, and I fought for you every minute of the fight.
I'm talking to John Zadrozny, who's the director of the Center for Homeland Security, on the Homeland Security front. So I think Sunday morning I was watching Fox interviewing people that were coming across the border. They'd been nabbed by the CBP. They were going to get a free ride to town, a ticket, and then probably sent on their way, which is what the Biden administration's been doing. And this reporter was saying, so where are you from? And one guy says, well, I'm from Guatemala. And then the next guy is from Ghana. And I said to Dean, I said, Ghana, that's the other side of the planet. And then the next guy was from Brazil. And I said, I'm not aware we're taking in refugees or asylum seekers from Brazil, but this is what's being done. Our southern border has become the entry point for Haiti, for Africa, for South America, for all these other places. This is not just Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador.
You're correct, Lars. It is. This is what an open border looks like, and it creates a huge risk for the American people. And you're seeing, like you mentioned Brazilians. We've heard that. We've heard Venezuelans, and they're not coming. They're not. The message I'm hearing from the people we talk to in the Border Patrol, it's not, thank God we're in America. I can't wait to be here. This is the greatest place in the world. It's where are our benefits? I want citizenship. And just as a quick note on the Venezuelan front, I want to remind you that it wasn't more than a few years ago when we discovered that the Venezuelans were issuing passports to Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations.
Absolutely right. That's John Zadrozny from the Center for Homeland Security. John, thanks so very much. Coming up in a moment, lane congestion done deliberately. We'll talk about that. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network. We serve Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk radio. Our Twitter poll today, would a New York Times columnist make a good governor for a Northwest state, in this case, the state of Oregon? And Nicholas Kristof, the 2 times Pulitzer Prize winner and thoroughgoing liberal who's taken a leave from the New York Times, he may just run for governor. In some ways, I'd kind of like to see it happen because I don't think he has the first clue what would be involved in running a state. But having said that, does it make sense? Yes, he grew up here, went to high school here, and then left for the better part of the rest of his, maybe a half century or so. And now he's come back and said, hey, I'd like to have the most important job, the most consequential job in any state, and that would be governor of the state. I'd say no to that. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let me go first to John. John, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KPNW. What's on your mind today?
Hey, I heard you talking about the unions earlier, and I actually agree with most of what you said. I feel like it's pretty accurate. I used to be non-union. I'm an electrician, and I came from a non-union shop to a union one. And what you were talking about with the attitudes is it's spot on. There's it's like a culture of laziness. People, you know, they take their breaks at exactly the right time, regardless of what stage of work they're in. really kind of sad, honestly. But I do kind of disagree with what you were saying about how it kind of might affect their future job placement. Because unfortunately, the companies that are strictly union or work with unions, a lot of times, they factor that lack of productivity into their estimates and their job costs. So a lot of these companies really plan on their workers kind of,
Dump it. John, I can't let you say, I can't. Did we dump that? I just want to make sure we dumped that.
Sorry.
Thank you. We got it. Yeah, you get me in big trouble with the FCC. That's the only, that's the government agency I have to worry about. So you, about the messing up. John, do you think it occurs to Americans that, you know, several decades ago, 30% of workers were represented by unions? Today in the private sector, now it's about 6%. Do you suppose it occurs to union members why unions have become so terribly unattractive, especially since in the last 30 years, the laws that protect your right to join a union if you want to, organize, collective bargaining, all that stuff, have become stronger and stronger, and the number of unions has gone down and down and down. Now, that's not a conspiracy. It's that workers look at it and say, why should I make the same paycheck as somebody who's not nearly as good as me?
So I agree with that, but I feel like there are some jobs where that might not actually apply. So like take construction, for instance, when enough of the tradesmen get together, they create like a market share. And so in the state of Oregon, there's so many electricians that get together, they form this union. They really control a lot of the workforce. And
well, but they control it. But John, if you think you're a really good electrician and your work, you're worth more than scale, why would you ever consent to work for scale and in effect share your extra talents with everybody else you work with who gets a bigger paycheck while you get a smaller paycheck? Why does that make sense? Why would that make sense to anybody?
For me specifically, and I hate to say it, but it's like this in a lot of the trades, I was a foreman non-union. Coming to the union, I got a substantial raise, and it ends up just penciling out financially for the individual. I don't think the system as a whole works because these unions get together and they can collectively bargain and basically force the government to set wages at whatever they want, benefits at, you know, pretty much whatever kind of benefits they want. The plumbers union really has it locked down. And
Sound like extortion to you?
It does, absolutely. But personally, I benefit from it. I don't agree with the system, but for my family and me personally, I'm taking part of it. But I don't necessarily agree with it. I think it's bad for society.
And see, I'm glad for you being honest that way, because I understand everybody should look out for their own best interests and their family's best interest. And I get that. But I think I'd feel guilty if I said, well, you know what, I'm getting a job or I'm getting a level of pay that I'm only getting through extortion. Well, any of us could engage in extortion. I could go to my next door neighbor, Chiwu, and put a gun to his head and say, listen, you either give me some money or bad things are going to happen to you. That's extortion. And you say, see, I got this money. Who could be proud of taking home a paycheck from extorting a higher wage than the marketplace says your skills are worth?
I'm not necessarily proud of it, but like I said, I feel like it's the system, and I could take a stand. I could go work non-union, and it really wouldn't benefit me one bit. My personal vote doesn't really matter. If there was a bill that came through, I would vote against it. No, I'm part of one.
Now, see, all I'd like to see, John, is in the 50 states, 28 of them are now right-to-work states. So you can join the union or not join the union. It's not required. The other states, a minority of states, are not. And I'll tell you where it comes home to you. We were asking the city I live in, Vancouver, when are you going to repave our road? And they said, well, we only have $10 million a year, so we have enough to do 20 jobs. And we have about 140 jobs that need to be done. And so they're working against a mountain of backlog of work. And as soon as I heard that, I thought, I've had these conversations with mayors and other people before. You know what prevailing wage is, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So it means that when they go to pave that road, it has to be paid at prevailing wage, even if it's done by a private company. Since that's typically 30 to 40% higher wages, for the workers, it's great. Now, what if you said, what if we could pave 30 roads every year if we paid market wages for paving those streets with that $10 million? You say, oh, that'd be great. Well, so who gets cheated in that case? The people who live on the road, who would have a brand new road, except we got to pay these excess wages that are only obtained through extortion. It's crazy.